Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Johnson, Judge Geitas, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding.
And good morning, everyone. Back to winter on April 14, 2021. This is a relatively abbreviated calendar of the Court of Appeals. We'll be proceeding shortly with our first oral argument. Want to remind the attorneys to introduce yourself and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument. If you have any technical difficulties and I don't notice it, be sure and wave your arm or do something to call my attention to it. And lastly, just a reminder that all of the rules of appellate procedure remain in place, including the prohibition against any outside taping or recording of these proceedings. I'm going to ask our marshal now to call the first case for presentation.
This is case number A20-1266. Capacity Wireless LLC versus Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota.
And appellate counsel, when you're ready to proceed, please do so.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Art Boylan and I represent the appellant, Capacity Wireless. There's two areas of focus today for the court. First, at summary judgment, the district court granted summary judgment on my client's claim for damages relating to certain costs that it had incurred. The summary judgment decision was based upon the court's conclusion that my client had admitted that we had not incurred such damages. The summary judgment record did
not- Well, we actually had the testimony from, I'm looking for his name, but we had the testimony, Mr. Rosenfeld, that other entities had in fact been responsible for those costs. I mean, I don't know how we get around that other than producing evidence that there was some later agreement, which I couldn't find in the record. If so, tell me what this evidence would have been.
Sure, Your Honor, jumping right to the deposition testimony. Actually, that's not what the deposition testimony says at all. The university has repeatedly said that in their initial memorandum. They said that in opposition. We said you didn't even meet your burden. And here's why. Docket number 18, exhibit 11, at 22, 33, 42 to 45. Here's what the actual testimony was. Capacity were the ones paying the money and paying the salaries of the people who were doing the work, and ultimately that money should be paid to us. Later, this is at page 52 of the deposition testimony, clearly the understanding was that the work was done and the expenses paid by Capacity, my client, or ultimately Capacity, LEMCON on behalf of Capacity eventually. Later, and this is in our opposition brief, this is docket number 31, exhibit 4, at page 200, we went through a long explanation. This is his answer of how it ultimately accrued the expenses or costs. Those were accrued to Capacity in the way that we discussed. That was the record at summary judgment based upon my client's deposition testimony. It may not be a model of clarity, but on summary judgment, we're entitled to all reasonable inferences drawn in our favor. There was no admission that my client had not incurred those costs. Instead, it was as if they went to the bank. The bank may have had that flow of funds coming out, but in the meantime, there's an account accruing where Capacity owes money to the bank. Under those circumstances, Capacity is ultimately going to have an obligation for them. Those are damages that have been incurred. Plus, Your Honor, moving on to the next piece of evidence.
Was that evidence presented at trial court summary judgment that there was a bank debt that your client owed?
Well, there was not, Your Honor, but respectfully, that doesn't make a difference.
It does make a difference because as an appellate body, we don't hear new arguments. It would have had to have been presented to the district court. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but it's by way of analogy. Here we have the same thing, where the testimony before the district court was that Capacity had incurred this obligation. They had become legally obligated for it. And the court said, I think there's admission that they have not incurred that obligation. There was more evidence, Your Honor, as well.
That's what I'm getting at. What is the factual evidence that they did, in fact, incur those costs other than just a statement, we had costs? That's pretty easy to make that plain.
Sure. And if the University of Minnesota wanted to say, no, you didn't, they needed to come forward with evidence affirmatively disproving it at summary judgment, not just relying on their assertion. And that's the first argument that we made in our opposition to summary judgment. And we repeat it here for your honor. On summary judgment, they didn't even meet their initial burden. They had no bank records. They had no absence of agreement. They had no testimony saying we never have to repay this. Instead, what we've got is deposition testimony from Mr. Rosenfeld saying capacity is ultimately on the hook for that.
Mr. Boylan, does the summary judgment record include financial statements or accounting records of capacity, the company, capacity itself?
No, Your Honor, but what we do have at the summary judgment record instead is the expert report of John Beck, who went through the detailed 1,400 individual line item transactions that he considered, he analyzed. In his opinion, it's plain. It says it repeatedly on page 16. This is docket number, docket 42, exhibit 50.
And I see on Appendix C of his report, he lists the documents that he reviewed. Included in those are some documents with P bait stamp numbers. I don't know what those are. I mean, most of the documents reviewed have other bait stamp numbers, third parties and the U and so on. But I guess it seems to me that if we want to know whether Capacity Wireless LLC actually had expenses, seems to me it makes sense to look at their own accounting records, either for the district court to look at them or for Mr. Beck to look at them. But and I don't see that was done.
On summary judgment, respectfully, if they wanted to say you did not incur them, they had an obligation to ask for that in discovery, demonstrate that there was no link, and then submit that to the court. They did not do that. At best, got his ambiguous testimony.
The testimony of the principal Rosenfeld, it is ambiguous, it seems. And it seems like there's, you quoted one excerpt. I think there's multiple excerpts quoted in, you know, all the briefs, but it seems like there was a fair amount of confusion but it seems like what he was trying to explain is that capacity may not have directly incurred the expenses, but other affiliated companies did, and ultimately capacity is responsible for that. But that might be a different thing, right?
I don't believe it is a different thing, Your Honor. First of all, on the summary judgment, all reasonable inferences drawn in my client's favor. We've got an expert report properly, should have been considered by the district court, was ignored. That expert said repeatedly, I met with Mr. Rosenfeld, I reviewed detailed financial records, accounting records, and his opinion was capacity incurred these. Plus, Your Honor, the difference is not cited for this purpose in our briefs, but cited elsewhere for other purposes. The TempWorks case, this court directly dealt with the question of, does it matter if you paid or incurred them? Literally looked at, let's look at the definition of incurred. The court, Minnesota Court of Appeals, said incurred is unambiguous. It means becoming liable to or subject to an expense. That's at 896 Northwest 2nd, 128. This court directly addressed the question of, is it just that someone else paid the expenses? No, because those folks, if you go look at the TempWorks case, it was relating to, were they liable for certain costs such that they could be shifted after a judgment? One of them paid all the costs. The others were the prevailing party. The question was, well, if you didn't pay any costs, how can you possibly get them awarded to you? The court concluded it doesn't matter if you paid the costs or not. What matters is whether or not you incurred an obligation. And under the circumstances there, those other prevailing parties had incurred an obligation because they would have had to repay the other defendant.
And so let me follow up on something Judge Werke said earlier, and that is, you know, were there agreements between capacity and affiliated companies about the obligation to reimburse or to shift these expenses from one to another? And was that in the record at all?
That was not in the record at summary judgment. It did come out at the trial, Your Honor, over objection. The University of Minnesota, I asked a few questions about it. It's on day 7 of the transcript, and the university actually drew it out of the witness. The actual flow of bank funds was from the partnership owned by Capacity through another entity. This is cited at page 30 of their brief. It's trial transcript, day 7 at around 1400. The actual bank flow, Lemcon paid it, but the effect was that Capacity did. We did an accounting of that. So whether there's a formal agreement or there's accounting, intercompany accounting records, we have evidence of that here.
In the trial record. But of course, for purposes of your first argument, we have to look at the summary judgment record, correct?
Mr. Boylan, my question is this. You've just stated that it was LEMCOM that incurred the cost. And that is that not what you said?
LEMCOM paid it. There's a difference between paying and incurring an obligation. And that's precisely the rub here. Capacity said to LEMCON, please pay these things, and we're keeping track, and we're going to have an obligation owed to you. It totaled about $1 million.
My recollection is Capacity, A, did not have a bank account, mm-hmm. and number two, there was no evidence of any responsibility for them to pay any of the other parties. I don't know how we can say Capacity was in fact the entity that incurred the expense if they have no ability other than their affiliation with other entities to go ahead and pay those expenses off.
Sure, Your Honor, if I open a line of credit with the bank and the bank actually pays my subcontractors for my benefit, is it really that I don't owe anything to the bank?
I agree with what you're saying, but to survive summary judgment, what record evidence can we look at? What can you point us to that will in fact assure us that there was a question?
Absolutely, there was a question. The deposition testimony that we just walked through, that with all reasonable inferences drawn in our favor, plus the expert reports completely ignored at the summary judgment phase that said repeatedly, and they are properly considered, they can create a genuine issue of material fact. John Beck repeatedly said Capacity incurred these expenses and did a detailed analysis supported by 1400 different line entries to be able to justify that testimony. Your Honor, they didn't meet their burden. I mean, when you look at it, first thing that's supposed to happen on summary judgment is they are supposed to demonstrate the absence of genuine issue of material fact. All of the questions that I've been posed today, they didn't answer. I'm entitled to all the reasonable inferences drawn from that. There was no admission that Capacity did not incur these expenses. In fact, there's record evidence demonstrating that they did, that the court should have considered, including John Beck, but also looking at the deposition testimony, and that created enough to have a genuine issue of material fact.
I mean, would you agree, Mr. Boylan, that when we read the Beck report, we have to read it with the Rosenfeld testimony in mind? In other words, to harmonize them, to read them together?
Correct, Your Honor. I would agree with that. I would also add the additional facts that Mr. Beck had before him was conversations with Mr. Rosenfeld to be able to understand what happened. Poorly worded deposition questions, he can amplify his understanding with interviews of witnesses, and that's precisely what he did here. It's in his reliance materials.
Did Mr. Rosenfeld ever submit an affidavit?
No. If I can spend the last 2 minutes talking about the Rule 608 issues that we have here, unless there's further questions about the summary judgment ruling on the damages, this is pretty plain. Rule 608 prohibits the use of extrinsic evidence. Here, the district court said, and this is at trial transcript, day 6, 1334, to about 1335. The district court said, no matter how you read it, it comes in. She later said, I don't think my ruling was limiting in any way. Rule 608B evidence is incredibly inflammatory. And as a result of that, courts are often cautioned to be careful about how they use and how they allow 608B testimony. Here, the questions that were asked by the university included reference to the conclusions and the consequences of another court. And it wasn't just one question like in TempWorks, it was dozens of questions going over and over and over again, including things like the judge found that, didn't the judge find that, didn't the judge find that. This was prejudicial, and it wasn't only prejudicial in the sense that all evidence is, it was unfair because it persuaded by illegitimate means. Why do I say that? The university now says that has nothing to do with the outcome on damages. In actuality, at the motion in limine phase, docket 142 at 20, they tied it directly to damages. We're gonna use this for damages. In their opening statement, they said, you gotta be careful, you can trust. And finally, they reiterated the connection in their closing as well. That's another basis for error and why we ought to be entitled to a new trial on damages.
Thank you, Mr. Boylan. Thank you for being mindful of the time frame. You'll have 5 minutes again for rebuttal after Mr. Pramas completes his argument.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Tim Pramas. I represent the University of Minnesota.
Before you start, Mr. Pramas, and before the clock, we'll start the clock again at 15 minutes. Mr. Prentice can reset it. Mr. Boylan, can you remain visible? I'm glad that you're muted, but I need you to remain visible. Thank you. Now we'll start.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Tim Pramas. I represent the University of Minnesota in this morning's appeal. I'm going to go a little out of order from my planned remarks and talk first about the expert report of Mr. Beck. Mr. Beck is not a fact witness. He was offered as an expert witness. He has no personal knowledge as to who paid the expenses, and to the extent he's merely repeating what someone told him and that testimony is being offered for the truth of the matter asserted, it's inadmissible hearsay. Mr. Beck reviewed, among other things, LEMCON, QuickBook accounting records that showed that LEMCON paid its own employees. Premise Concepts paid its own employees. There's nothing in the Beck report that is inconsistent with what appears to be an undisputed fact, and that is that Capacity Wireless did not pay anything out of pocket. So Mr. Beck's expert witness report, unsworn, no affidavit or declaration.
Well, let me hold you there, Mr. Premise. I mean, are you truly making the argument that because it was unsworn that the court should not have considered Mr. Beck's testimony? Or is that just one of those terms that goes along with affidavit or report that you're saying unsworn?
Yeah, there's no testimony from Mr. Beck. His report was submitted as an exhibit, but there's no testimony from Mr.
That's
Beck.
That's what I'm getting at. It didn't need to be sworn, didn't need to be under oath, did it?
Well, for summary judgment purposes, testimony either in the form of a deposition or an affidavit or declaration, it has to be in a form that would be admissible. And the report itself isn't admissible.
I'm clearly not going to take your time on that, but I beg to differ and ask you to look at Montemayor at some point, but go ahead with your argument. I think we were saying the same thing, but I just disagree with your conclusion.
Sure. And the important thing is I don't think this issue rises or falls on Montemayor just because Mr. Beck has no personal knowledge as to who paid, and he's not attempting to assert that he has personal knowledge. He's relying on what someone else told him, and the documents he's reviewing are documents from LEMCON, Premise Concepts, et cetera. He's not reviewing any evidence that shows that Capacity Wireless paid any money. He's not reviewing any agreement or contract that somehow obligates Capacity Wireless for any expense anyone else paid. It's of course black.
So Mr. Pramas, I'm looking at the attachments to the report, and in addition to payroll, there's also payments to vendors such as Border States Electric, Construction Risk Management, and so on. So do we know who made those payments to those third parties?
LEMCON did.
Okay.
And that's from Mr. Rosenfeld's deposition that's cited in our memorandum. I asked him who paid these expenses, and it was LEMCON.
How do you respond to Attorney Boylan's remark that it's somewhat ridiculous to assume that just because you aren't the payor, the actual one that writes the check, that it overlooks the fact that you could have a line of credit and go ahead and incur costs?
But I understand his argument, but that's not the record. The one paragraph in their SJ, in their summary judgment response on, and their response on this issue is limited to one paragraph, is that Capacity Wireless is LEMCON's affiliate. Therefore, Capacity Wireless is the proper party to recover for what other entities paid. But there's still no evidence in the record as to what the corporate relationship is between LEMCON and Capacity Wireless. Quote, affiliate, close quote, has no specific legal meaning. And at the summary judgment stage, there was no evidence of any agreement that Capacity Wireless somehow, someday, in some way, might ultimately have to repay LEMCON. That simply wasn't in the record at the time of summary judgment. That wasn't argued at the time of summary judgment. The district court pointed out both at the time of summary judgment and in her order denying the new trial motion that there are two facts that Capacity consistently does not dispute, that it never paid any out-of-pocket expenses and that it was other entities who paid those out-of-pocket expenses. Merely because there's some sort of loose corporate affiliation does not mean that Capacity Wireless legally can recover expenses that other parties paid. Even if it's a more formal affiliation, like a wholly owned subsidiary and a parent corporation, or two corporations that have common owners, one corporation cannot sue to recover what another entity paid. That's simply black letter Minnesota law, certainly, and certainly nationally. At trial.
And what is that case law, Mr. Primus, that you're referring to?
It's in our memorandum on the out-of-pocket damages. I'm sorry, I'll find that.
I can find it as well. You can go. You can proceed.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I didn't have those case names handy, but I'm not referring to anything other than the cases that we cited in our appellate brief. As Your Honor pointed out, Capacity Wireless had no bank account, had no employees, so it had no payroll, it had no employees, had no bank account, had no money. Capacity's owners invested no money in Capacity Wireless, so of course Capacity did not pay any of these expenses. And furthermore, the memorandum of understanding, the underlying contract in existence, had no provision that required the university to reimburse Capacity for any expenses it paid, and certainly no contract between it and any other entity like LEMCON. The trial testimony, which shouldn't be considered pursuant to the Minnesota Supreme Court's 1998 Wall decision, doesn't change the result. That testimony's a hash. There's still no legal authority cited to this court that Capacity is liable for payments that LEMCON or Premise Concepts or any other entity made. Summary judgment was the correct result based on the record before the district court, and we respectfully request that a summary judgment be affirmed. Turning to the, again, going a little bit out of order, the issue about the Massachusetts lawsuit. I'll get to Rule 608D in a moment, but there are two reasons why the district court did not abuse her discretion when she allowed testimony regarding Mr. Rosen, the federal judge's finding regarding Mr. Rosenfeld's misconduct in that underlying lawsuit. The first is that it's directly relevant and probative of probably the principal issue in the case. And it's relevant both to liability and to damages. For liability, the university's state of mind and motivation was directly at issue. One of the claims in the case is that the university acted in bad faith, breaching an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Basically, the accusation was we had some ulterior, dishonest motive. The university needed to be allowed to put into evidence our state of mind and our motivation for our decisions. After learning about the Massachusetts lawsuit, the university was unwilling to sign a 30-year master licensing agreement with Mr. Rosenfeld's company. After learning about the Massachusetts lawsuit, we did not want Mr. Rosenfeld to continue to be the university's representative in negotiations with carriers. Mr. Rosenfeld did not disclose this lawsuit, even though our request for proposal, exhibits 13 and 17, specifically asked him to identify prior litigation. And this was even though the Massachusetts lawsuit, the judge's findings were issued months before he responded to the request for proposal. Besides liability, this is also relevant to the issue of damages. There are two conditions precedent for capacity to recover lost profit damages. One is that the university would need to sign a master licensing agreement with capacity for capacity in turn to be able to sublicense or sell rights to carriers, and that's how capacity would generate revenue. If there's no master licensing agreement, there can be no revenue or nothing for capacity to profit from. And Mr. Gulacek, the university's CIO, chief information officer, testified that after he learned about the federal judge's findings, there was no chance he would ever expose the university to any risk in entering into a master licensing agreement with capacity.
Mr. Pramis, did you ever introduce any record evidence that would show that you would have researched capacity or Rosenfeld's background before you ever would have entered into an MLA? I mean, is there some process by which you would have to do that vetting? And if so, was that information ever presented?
I mean, the information was presented that we did, obviously we did ultimately do the research.
I understand it, the research was done by an individual. I don't really understand the basis, more of a whim or just something looking through. It wasn't part of a process that you were vetting, was it?
It wasn't part of a process. The way it arose is the carriers expressed to us, Diane Wollner, specifically the chief of staff, some concern about capacity's financial capability and the lack of their knowledge of him in the industry. And that caused her to then begin the research where she discovered the Massachusetts lawsuit. So it's a tough the reason I struggle with answering it is it's sort of a hypothetical. If we didn't find out about it, would there have been another opportunity to find out about it? I think so, but I'm hesitant to speculate about that because we didn't really go down that road. We just explained what prompted her, Diane Wollner, to do the research and what actually happened as to how we learned about it. So we didn't really offer testimony that we might have found out about it some other way. I mean, the answer is typically for a new contract, there would be a process, but I'm hesitant to say anything about that because I'm not sure that's in the record. But in any event, we did find out about it. And after learning about it, that's why we did what we did, why we negotiated with carriers rather than have Mr. Rosenfeld be our representative, and why we didn't sign a master licensing agreement. Now, the other side's argument is that our witnesses simply weren't credible, but that's a jury question. There was nothing that the district court decided that foreclosed the ability of capacity to argue that our witnesses weren't credible. And capacity said so in their opening statement, their closing argument, and they extensively cross-examined all university witnesses trying to attack our credibility. And the jury considered that. Importantly, It's also, so the district court judge did not abuse her discretion in a Rule 403 analysis that this evidence of the federal judge's findings, the probative value was not substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice. The fact that it was a federal court decision after trial, the opportunity to cross-examine, call witnesses, present exhibits was significant to the university because it wasn't simply a disgruntled former business partner making the accusation. It was a federal judge after trial who made the findings of fraud, deceit, et cetera. Independently, this information is admissible under Rule 608D. B. That rule specifically gives the district court discretion to allow a party to inquire through cross-examination about specific instances of conduct relevant to the witness's character for truthfulness. That's exactly how that cross-examination occurred. Extrinsic means a source other than the witness himself, and no extrinsic document was offered or received into evidence. Under Cole in the Fifth Circuit and Dawson in the Seventh Circuit, cases cited in our brief, references to a judge's findings are permissible. You simply are prohibited from offering the document itself, the opinion itself, as an exhibit. To the extent the claim is that somehow I improperly referenced the judge's finding, that was waived, that wasn't argued in the pretrial motion in limine, and it was not, the only argument capacity raised was with respect to Rule 403 sort of analysis. In any event, it wasn't prejudicial because ultimately capacity failed to establish damages. I see my time's up, so in conclusion, the university respectfully requests that the district court's decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. And we turn back to you now, Mr. Boylan. You have the last word.
Great. Thank you, Your Honor. Couple of clarifications. This happens a number of times in the memorandum as well. They claim we only cited one paragraph. There was only one sentence. That's a misreading of our opposition to summary judgment on this question of incurrence of damages. Docket 29 at 58-62, all of our damages actually fit together. And Your Honor, respectfully, the way that this worked was everyone agrees, even the university in their opposition brief before this court explains that what happens is a neutral host, like capacity, makes an investment in the property, incurs costs related to it, and ultimately, what's expected is the AT&T, Verizon, et cetera's of the world will sign up to be on the system to transmit their signal. And the neutral host, such as capacity, is going to get its investment back plus a hoped for return. Everybody agrees that that's the way this was set up. And that's exactly the investment that capacity was making here.
There was evidence that AT&T and all of the other like entities said that they didn't have anything going with capacity. I mean, how?
Actually, that's not right, Your Honor. That's what the university says in their memorandum. There was some testimony saying we hadn't yet reached a final agreement.
There was not a final agreement.
There was no final agreement between them, but the record, both at summary judgment as well as at trial, demonstrated that the carriers had agreed on pricing, which is the critical, most important piece of the puzzle. What they hadn't done was signed a contract yet, but they had agreed on we will pay that price per month to be in those locations. What they did not have yet signed was an actual license agreement to do it. But the critical terms of that were already agreed to, and it factored into our experts' analysis of what is this value worth. The court agreed to allow us to have a discounted cash flow analysis presented. Part of that discounted cash flow, it was submitted at summary judgment and it was a part of trial. Part of that discounted cash flow, and you can read about it at docket 32, exhibit 8, at pages 30 through 34. Discounted cash flow says, what do we expect the inflows to be after we consider your investment? What do we expect the cash flows to be? That was another piece of the puzzle, another expert that explained, I've looked at this, there's a portion of this that relates to the investment that Capacity had to make. And that actually was presented to the court at summary judgment, and it was presented during the trial itself. What we were missing, of course, was Mr. Beck being able to say, here's the cost that Capacity had incurred. So we only were able to present two legs of our three-legged stool because they took away the piece that was, here's an accounting of all the dollars that were expended and that you're liable for.
Mr. Boylan, I mean, this may seem like a sort of fundamental question, but I'm struggling to understand how the out-of-pocket damages relate to the MOU and your causes of action. I mean, aren't these, isn't this sort of a risk that Capacity, even if Capacity had made the expenditures, was going to take regardless of whether an MLA was ultimately entered?
You're right on, and maybe I'm not being clear enough yet, Your Honor. The MOU gave my client the exclusive right to negotiate. The discounted cash flow wasn't about once an MLA gets signed, what's that worth? Everybody knew that this was a hugely valuable asset, the ability to transmit wireless signals at the University of Minnesota. The question is, what is that worth? And that's what the Altman-Verlandry expert report addressed. As a part of that, you have to say, well, even if it's there, how much is it going to take in terms of an investment to get it up and running and get it cash flowing? You have to have what's the investment to be able to understand what is the total value that's presented here. And that's how those two fit together. And that's why pages 58 to 62 describe them together. We were precluded from putting one of those elements of our damages before the jury. That was prejudicial. It was an error. And we ought to be entitled to a new trial to be able to fully explain our damages to the jury.
Thank you to both attorneys. I, speaking for the panel, will say the matters were very well briefed, as well as the arguments were presented in good fashion today. The decision will be issued within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you for appearing.
Thank you.